A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hello, I'm Mark Riley.
And I'm Rob Hughes.
And you're listening to the A to Z of David Bowie, the greatest rock and roll star in the world, ever, ever.
W is for Woody Woodmansey.
So Michael Woodmansey, born the 4th of February 1951, Driffield, Yorkshire, his father being Douglas Woodmansey, originally from the village of Langtoft, also Yorkshire, spent many years serving in the British Army.
His mother was Annie, a nurse born and bred in Driffield. She carried on working whilst carrying the unborn Woody right up until the last minute when she passed out on a ward whilst on duty, Mark. Shortly afterwards, her son Woody entered the world.
Annie's father was less than overjoyed with the arrival of little Michael, as he had been conceived and born out of wedlock, but her mother was adamant that Annie and Woody would continue to live in the family home. Woody grew up with his mum in his grandparents' house situated in a new council estate. Also living there at the time were Annie's uncle, Edward, a sister, Deanie, and the two brothers, Harold and Ernest. It's a busy old household, that, isn't it?
Absolutely. As a child, Mick went by the name Mick Bradley, his mother's maiden name. On one occasion, bad feelings grew between Woody's household and some neighbours. They insisted young Woody was annoying them with his drum kit, but the thing was, he didn't own a drum kit yet. Deciding it might be a good idea to give them something to moan about, so his folks went out and bought him a snare drum.
So when Woody was 5 years old, his parents got wed. Okay, so we're going to go now. We're going to be dipping in at various junctures throughout this podcast episode into Woody's book, My Life with Bowie, Spider from Mars, Woody Woodmansey, foreword by Tony Visconti.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So we're going to move on to page 7, I think, aren't we here?
We are.
So here we go. Woody's childhood. After you'd had a bath, it was too wet in there for you to put your clothes on, so you had to wrap a towel around you and sprint to the house through the wind, rain and snow thinking, fuck! Being clean took courage. This was normal back then, by the way. We weren't a poor family, although there wasn't a lot of spare money. After a couple of years, we moved into the upstairs flat, a considerably nicer place, with an inside toilet.
It was quite a shock for me to leave the Bradleys, where I was part of a large, warm family who gave me a lot of attention. About a year after my parents married, my sister Pamela was born, which was something else to adjust to. But the most difficult thing was living with a dad I hardly knew, having only seen him when he was home on leave. He was very strict. I wasn't allowed to jump on furniture or walk on walls like you do as a kid. I guess I got used to the more relaxed atmosphere at my gran's house, where I've been the only child in the family. His viewpoint was that I was spoilt. To me, he looked a bit like John Wayne, a bit of a hard man. I began to have a troubled relationship with my dad at this point. He carried a chip on his shoulder for quite a while, as I'd effectively come along and interrupted his army life. He had a lot of mates in the army and none at home, so he didn't have much of a social life because he was a young dad. I was the object of his frustration, basically, and that took a lot of getting used to. It's tough for a kid to feel like his father resents him, although I realised there were some extenuating circumstances.
Yeah, he continues, sometimes my dad's annoyance would be frightening. My mum would set the table for Sunday lunch, and if he was in a bad mood, he'd grab a corner of the tablecloth and rip the whole thing off. My dinner would be in front of me, and then all of a sudden it was dripping off the wall. This was scary behaviour.
Awful, isn't it? Okay, yeah. So let's move on then now. So moving on to 1965 now, Woody's aged 14. He'd been something of a disruptive element in the class at school and was often in bother with the teachers. As a result, he got a bad school report, which followed through to haunt him as he went on to sit his O-levels, despite having knuckled down in the months leading up to them. Woody himself thought he'd done pretty well, but it transpired that his performance had been marked down due to his previous misdemeanours.
Ooh. With this, he was faced with the option of either leaving the education system completely or being kicked out, and he chose the former. When asked what he wanted to do with his life, Woody proclaimed he was going to be a pop star, to which the headmaster, a guy called John Harrison, proclaimed, "You're a moron, Woodmansey, and you always will be."
Woody went on to join a band called The Mutations, which is a great name, and got his first proper gig at the Book Hotel in Driffield. The band's set consisted of Booker T's Green Onions and the Stones' Satisfaction. They also had an original song called Swan Lake.
Interesting. Okay. Despite not being a big fan of Woody's chosen profession, his dad used to drive his lad to gigs, and by this time The Mutations were big in Driffield. Having secured a regular slot at the Book, he was earning a few quid as a plumber's apprentice, with the odd dabble at being a rookie electrician. Neither of which convinced Woody that a serious career in either of those things beckoned.
Real life did enter when Woody got a job in the Vertex Spectacle Factory. He actually enjoyed the job and was pretty good at it.
It was at the same time that another local band called the Roadrunners, whom the Mutations had supported on occasion, happened upon Woody ambling around Driffield and shouted, "Woody, get in!" This was an invitation to join the band and go up another rung on the showbiz ladder. Life was good. Woody was getting ever closer to being the pop star that he'd warned his headmaster about.
Though young love would prove to get in the way, and a girlfriend's ultimatum ultimately saw the Roadrunners running no more, ah bless, so they split up. The following 3 months saw Woody without a band, and then this happened.
Okay, so we return to the Book here. At the time, the coolest band in Yorkshire were the Rats. Their guitarist Mick Ronson had a great reputation, which I realised was fully deserved when I saw the band at an open-air festival in 1969. I was blown away by his presence on stage and his guitar playing. He was 4 years older than me and had been playing in bands since 1963 when I was just a kid. It later turned out he'd seen me drum with the Roadrunners at the same event. The Rats had experience, having spent time in London doing gigs, but they'd never quite got the attention they deserved from the record companies. The music they made varied from blues to rock covers and even psychedelia. They'd been known as Treacle for a while. They were one of the first bands from our area to get really big amplifiers. The stage was filled with gear and it looked really impressive.
A few months after I saw Mick play at that outdoor event, I was at Vertex doing overtime on a Sunday when I looked up from the glazing wheel at my workbench and the Rats were standing there. They'd sneak through security and ask people where I was. "We're the Rats and my name is Mick Ronson," Mick told me, before introducing their singer Benny Marshall and their bassist Keith Ched Cheeseman. Mick looked very cool. He had long blonde hair and was wearing a crisp white shirt, a long black coat and neatly pressed black trousers with black slip-on shoes, almost like a young English Tom Petty. "Pleased to meet you," I said. "How did you get in here?"
"We sneaked in," he smiled. "We needed to talk to you." It turned out that the Rats had come all the way over from Hull to ask me to join them. That was quite a compliment, and they were all really nice guys, so of course, I took it seriously. Mick said that their drummer, John Cambridge, had left, and they wanted me to join the Rats. He added they'd have to come to the audition and pretend I hadn't got the job yet, as they'd promised an audition to six other drummers who had insisted on having one.
"No problem," I replied. Inside, I was delighted. This was a break I needed. I liked being in the Roadrunners, but the Rats were a much more professional band, and I knew that I'd fit in with a guitar player as good as Mick.
Oh, of course you would.
Of course you would, absolutely. Okay, so let's crack on. So Woody's tenure with the Rats proved to be not only another step in the right direction of local stardom, but it was also pivotal to his career.
The Rats were doing well on the local circuit, but despite this, Woody and Mick formed an offshoot band. Struggling to sing and play guitar at the same time, they brought in a bloke called Alan Palmer, who would later go on to change his name to Robert Palmer. Yes, that Robert Palmer.
So Woody was working at Vertex during the day and gigging at night. Life was good until 1969. Ex-Rats drummer John Cambridge lured Ronson away to the bright lights of London to hook up with a bloke called David Bowie, who'd enjoyed a hit single with Space Oddity.
Luckily for Woody, it was proving to be a hit at the Vertex factory and it looked like his future lay in the spec industry. One Friday afternoon, Woody was hauled into his Vertex boss's office and offered a better job position and a decent raise, and he had the weekend to think it all over. But then, something happened.
This is again going back to Woody's Book. Chapter 3, All the Mad Men. "Is that Woody?" said a voice on the phone. I said, "It was. I'm David Bowie." "Hello there," I replied, surprised. "Mick Ronson gave me your number," he told me. "I've got a band down in London. I believe you know my drummer, John Cambridge." "Yes, I know John," I said. "Well, John's leaving the band," he continued. "Mick says you're a really great drummer and you fit in perfectly as a player and as a person. So do you want to come down to us in London? You don't have to audition. The job's yours if you want it. And I've got a place where you can live. I also have Tony Visconti on bass, and he's my producer."
This is great. What an opportunity. He continued, "He sounded polite, and Mick had taken the trouble to recommend me to him, so I didn't want to be rude to the guy. I said, 'Sounds good to me, David, but I just need to look at a few things.' He was keen to get an answer from me, so I said I'd call him back on Monday. It might be difficult to imagine now, but in early 1970, Bowie seemed like a one-hit wonder. His single, Space Oddity, which got to number 5 in the charts, had come and gone, and the follow-up, The Prettiest Star, had flopped. His first album, David Bowie, had been released in 1967 and included whimsical songs like The Laughing Gnome and Love You Till Tuesday. It hadn't worked, and neither had the second album, also called David Bowie, bizarrely, which came out in autumn 69. Not that I'd listened to it. I'd been listening to bands like Cream and Led Zeppelin over the previous couple of years. Bowie's influences were obviously completely different. My friends wouldn't even know who Bowie was if I asked them about him.
On the other hand, Bowie's band, who are now called The Hype, were obviously talented, which appealed to me. The four musicians had made a bit of progress, but not much. They played a John Peel show on the 5th of February and done some gigs around London. One of these was unusual because they dressed up as superheroes. Bowie was Rainbow Man, Tony Visconti was Hype Man, Mick was Gangster Man, and John Cambridge was Cowboy Man. That show, with its theatricality, had been seen since as one of the moments that inspired the UK glam scene.
Most importantly, he concludes, as I saw it, Mick and I were like brothers.
One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
The A to Z of David Bowie with Mark Riley and Rob Hughes.
After a couple of false starts with the Bowie setup and the Hype, including a brief spell as Ronno, Woody ended up firmly ensconced in the Haddon Hall tribe with Ronson, Visconti, David and Angie living a hand-to-mouth existence.
Yeah, well, and we've already covered the Haddon Hall and the Hype stuff, but again, in this book, there's a wonderful story about where Woody said that they'd throw all money into the hat, then Angie would take money out of it, she'd go shopping, come back with food and burn it.
Yeah, terrible chef.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a great... This book is brilliant. I absolutely love it.
Over the next 3 years, Woody saw Bowie and his bandmates leap from struggling prog metal rockers to the backing band for David Bowie, who'd found his feet as a songwriter with Hunky Dory, and then dragged them upwards and onwards with the Ziggy Stardust album. 3 years of travelling the world and adulation followed, which famously came to an end at the Hammersmith Odeon on 3rd of July 1973 when Bowie pulled the plug on the project. Or whatever you want to call Ziggy, really, and that was the end of Woody's tenure.
It was, yeah, again, well documented throughout this podcast. And so we'll go to the autobiography now then, page 218, Bobbert.
That last night, the Hammersmith Odeon was probably one of the best shows we'd ever done. We tore through the set and everything just seemed to fall into place. Bowie was particularly on form. Every move he made was delivered with an extra something that made the whole show electrifying. After a blistering version of White Light, White Heat, the Hammersmith audience were going berserk. It got even wilder when Bowie stepped up to the microphone and announced, "As this is our last concert of the tour, we thought we'd do something special for you, so we invited one of our friends, and I know you'll give a big, warm welcome to Jeff Beck."
Jeff walked on to thunderous applause and Mick started the riff to Gene Genie. It was a particularly special moment as Jeff Beck was one of Mick's guitar heroes. We did an extended version of the song where they each took it in turn to solo back and forth. It was a Gene Genie like we'd never played it before. Jeff stayed on for Round and Round and then left the stage to great applause. Then there was a longer than usual gap, but luckily the audience were still making one hell of a noise. Bowie then stepped up to the microphone and signalled with his hands that he wanted the audience to be quiet. They immediately calmed down. Everybody, this has to be one of the greatest tours of our lives, he said. I would like to thank the band. I would like to thank our road crew. I would like to thank our lighting people. Of all the shows on this tour, this particular show will remain with us the longest, because not only is it the last show of this tour, it's the last show we'll ever do. Thank you.
My first thought was, what did he just say? Did he just say it's the last show we'll ever do? My eyes went to Trevor, who, judging by the look of confusion on his face, was thinking exactly the same. I looked around at the other guys on the stage, and most of them wore the same bemused expression. Some of the audience began shouting out, no, 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 and I could see many of the fans close to the stage in tears. Then Hutch, the auxiliary rhythm guitarist, started playing the intro chords to Rock and Roll Suicide, and we were into the final song of the show. Throughout the song, I was wondering if it was just another Bowie's publicity stunts. Had he planned this, or was it just spur of the moment? He'd done many things like this before without informing us. By the end of the number, I was actually quite annoyed, so I threw one of my drumsticks in his direction, obviously with no malice intended, as it missed his head by about 6 feet.
Then Bowie said to the audience, bye-bye, we love you, and we left the stage. As Trevor and I walked back to the dressing room, we quizzed each other about what he'd said and what it was all about. I guess it was still not enough information at that point for us to reach a conclusion. When we questioned Mick in the dressing room, he said, as far as I know, he's quit, but I'm not sure what it all means. You need to ask him. We then went around asking various crew members if they had any more concrete information. Some said they'd been told that it was, he'd finished with Ziggy. Others said they thought it was a big stunt, and many were just as confused as we were. Bowie had already left the venue by this time.
So I decided that, as there was an after-show party, I'd catch up with him there and hopefully get an answer. The party was held at the Café Royal on Regent Street, and I'd already seen the guest list, which included Ringo, Lulu, Jagger, Lou Reed, Jeff Beck, Cat Stevens, Peter Cook, Britt Eklund, Elliot Gould and Keith Moon, one of my heroes. Mick had already left for the party, so Trevor and I went together in a cab. As well as getting the truth about that statement, I had another important mission in mind. I was leaving the following morning to go home to Yorkshire to get married. June and I had planned to get married at the end of the tour and had finally settled on a date. We'd have a registry office wedding on the 5th of July with close family and friends from Yorkshire. We'd also planned a short service down in Sussex for our friends on the 7th at a Scientologist church. I'd asked Mick to be my best man for that and also invited David along, who'd said he'd be there. As we'd done all this at real short notice, due to not knowing when the tour would actually finish, we hadn't got together any official invitations. It was all verbal. So I wanted to remind David and Mick about the wedding that night.
Arriving at the Café Royal, we were confronted by a red carpet and a bunch of photographers madly flashing away as we exited the cab. The place was jam-packed with guests. I'd hoped to see Keith Moon, but there were so many people I never did, and we tried to get to Bowie, but he was just surrounded by the likes of Jagger, Lou Reed, Jeff Beck and Ringo. It soon became clear to us that this wasn't the time or place for any serious band discussions, or wedding reminders for that matter. June and I were married, as planned, in Bridlington Register Office with both sets of our parents and our families and a few old friends present. June had made me a suit as well as a wedding dress over the previous 2 days. She added the porcelain buttons to a dress that I bought from Japan.
Then we came back down to Sussex for the second ceremony. However, Mick and David didn't show up. We didn't know what had happened to them, but we couldn't wait any longer, so Trevor stepped in as best man and Jeff McCormack gave June away. Some of the road crew and entourage were guests too. Trevor's daughter, Sarah, was a flower girl, along with Mike Garson's daughter, Jenny. I got a call about an hour and a half after the wedding ceremony while I was getting changed at the house of a friend of myself and Mick. I assumed it was somebody phoning to say congratulations, but no, it was Tony DeFreeze who said, I'm calling to tell you that you won't be going to France to record the Pin-Ups album. Why not? I said. I was a little shocked. It was not a statement I was expecting to hear, especially on my wedding day.
Well, you said you didn't want to be in the band anymore. He was referring to the moment 6 months earlier when I'd refused to do the remaining dates during the second US tour unless we got a pay rise. Yes, but we got through all that and sorted out the money, didn't we? I said. And we've done 2 tours since then. But you said you didn't want to do it, he repeated. I could tell by his tone that this wasn't something I could argue my way out of. Standing there, it struck me suddenly that I'd had enough of this insanity. Not as a musician or a rock star, just as a person. I'd had enough. I really didn't feel like fighting it. I asked if David and Mick were there with him, and as I honestly just wanted to say something like, no hard feelings, all the best. After all, we have been close friends for some time. Yes, they are both here, he said. OK, can I speak to David, I asked.
After a few seconds of silence, he answered, he doesn't want to speak to you. All right, I said, put Mick on. He doesn't want to speak to you either, he said. I just said, OK, and put the phone down. I was speechless. Trevor came in and said to him, do you know who's just called me? He could see by my face that something terrible had happened. DeFreeze, I knew you were going to get that call, but I didn't want to spoil your wedding, so I didn't tell you about it. Why the fuck would they call me right now? He just looked at me unhappily. My mind was reeling. It was hard to believe that they would sack me in what should have been my happy day.
Pretty grim, that. Oh,
absolutely.
It? That's just, there's no class in that. And I'm sure we mentioned before that there is a story that Bowie did call up Trevor Boulder just before Trevor passed away to apologise for the way that he was treated. And the way that Woody was treated was pretty despicable as well. And also, if you look at it, must have really hurt him that Bowie wouldn't speak to him. It must have really, really hurt Woody that Mick wouldn't speak to him.
Yeah, absolutely. They've been through so much together.
Yeah.
You know, that gang mentality and everything.
And, we've got to know Woody Woodmansey, and he's such a wonderful fella. He really is. He's just so funny. He's so infectious to be around. I absolutely think the world of him. He's not a close mate. I'm not trying to pass him off as that, but I know him pretty well.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of back and forth with him and interviewed him a few times. And he's just a genuinely brilliant fella. And of course, an amazing drummer. That's the thing, right? Okay, with their drummers, and I can say this without anybody contradicting me, but Mike Joyce was a great drummer in the Smiths. Mm. He's a miles better drummer now.
Yeah,
he's
yeah.
older.
Yeah,
he's just been playing longer.
Yeah.
And you hear Woody playing on all of the Spider stuff. Absolutely brilliant and perfect. But you hear him drumming now, and he's even better.
Yeah.
And it's funny, going back to the passage there where he's talking about the Hammersmith Odeon show and the confusion. So it was quite recently, Four Cheap Things, that I interviewed a guy called Robin Mayhew.
Yeah.
So Robin, he'd been mixed up with various other bands, and at one point his band that he was doing the sound for was doing a gig with Bowie.
Mm.
Okay, and so what happened was their band went on first, and he did an amazing job with the sound. He had this PA which was like top notch, and then Bowie went on, and it sounded shocking. And he got a tap on the shoulder from Angie Bowie, and she said, "My husband would like to have a word with you." So Bowie said to him, "Look, your band were playing really loud, but we could hear every word that your singer was coming out with. I sounded terrible. What was that all about?" And so Robin just said, "Well, it's a great PA, and I know how to use it." So Bowie said, "Right, will you come on tour with us?"
Right.
He did the Ziggy tour right from the start, the rehearsals, at a rugby club, I think it was. And then he did all of the Ziggy tour, and he did all of the Aladdin Sane tour.
Mm.
And the funny thing is that he's got a bootleg of the last night of the Hammersmith Odeon.
Right.
Because he did record every single night of the tour, both tours, Ziggy and Aladdin Sane. And he only had one cassette. And this was at the insistence of Mick Ronson anyway, who wanted, if something went wrong in a show, Mick Ronson would listen to it the next day and go, "Right, thanks very much. I know what we did wrong there." Give him the cassette back.
Yeah, sure.
And then he would record that night's show on it.
Mm.
And so it must have been so knackered by the end of these 2 years of touring or whatever. But the thing was that he did record every night, but only the very last one exists, which is, of course, a Hammersmith Odeon.
Yeah, yeah.
Because after that, he had no more shows to rub it with because they'd split up. But the thing was, I asked him about whether he knew what was going on or not. And he said, "I didn't at the start of the show." He said, "But during the interval," because the show did have a break in the middle, didn't it?
Yes, yeah.
And he said, "During the interval," I can't remember the guy's name, but he was a stage kind of roadie. He was a guy who looked after all of the stage needs for Bowie and the Spiders. And he said, "My intercom went off at the soundboard." This is Robin. And it was his mate. I think he might have been called Pete, was it? But he said, "I think this is the last show, you know." And he's like, and Robin's going, what are you saying? He said, "I think this is the last show we're ever going to do." And he's going, "Oh, right, okay." And then they came on. So he had that little bit of a heads up.
Ah, all right. That's
but only halfway through the show.
Oh, wow.
And it's a great interview with Robin Mayhew. He's a really top fella. So you should probably get your ears around that. Well, only if you're a member of Cheap Things, actually.
So continuing then with Woody, unlike Mick Ronson and Trevor Boulder, as we've just discussed in the book, Woody didn't follow Bowie to France for the pin-up sessions. Ainsley Dunbar took over on the drum duties. And once Mick flew solo, once again, Trevor was on board, but Woody wasn't.
Yeah, after the Ronson gig fizzled out, Woody and Trevor formed the Spiders. We've covered them previously, haven't we, in this podcast, but that didn't really come to anything. And then Woody's next vehicle, was U-Boats, which again didn't really go too far.
No, and we have covered that as well, haven't we?
Yeah, but non-Bowie-related drum duties also included...
Yeah, Art Garfunkel.
Well, the Cybernauts, which was a kind of the start of what he's doing now with Holy Holy, in a way.
Yeah, Dexy's Midnight Runners, plus various other session engagements. There's a great little part in the book, isn't there? He's talking about his time with Dexy's and Kevin has to make the tea.
Yeah, it's absolutely brilliant. And obviously, we talked about the fact that he co-leads Holy Holy with Tony Visconti. And that is just something really, really great that you should probably see.
Yeah, and as we've been reading from it, Woody published his autobiography, Spider from Mars, My Life with David Bowie, in 2016. It was co-written with author Joel McIver and includes a foreword by Tony Visconti.
Do you know, I've seen Woody doing Q&As on two different occasions.
Yeah.
So one was at the Refuge, the Palace Hotel, as it is now.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And that was actually in the company of John Robb.
Mm.
And it was a festival, Louder Than Words, that John Robb organises. John also being a member of the Membranes,
yeah,
who are a punk band from Blackpool who played alongside The Fall and all those people back in the day. And John Robb stepped in at the last minute because Joel McIver, previously mentioned, got stuck in traffic on his way there. And it looked at one point in time like I was going to be drafted in to do it. And I'd never met Woody before at that point in time.
Oh, was that your first time? Was
yeah.
It?
Oh. And so I was slightly terrified by that. But luckily, John Robb, who's much better at those kind of things, stepped in and did it. And you just immediately engage with it. Mm. But the second time that I saw Woody doing a Q&A was just absolutely brilliant. And it was with Dave Simpson, The Guardian and various other publications. But that was at the Deer Shed Festival. And it was in the company of Ken Scott.
Mm.
And that was such a brilliant day because he interviewed Ken, and then Woody came on, and then both together. And the stories that those two came up together was just like absolutely the most engaging hour you could possibly hope to spend.
That must have been great for both of them, though, because not often they'd be in a room together and just kind of riffing off each other and one memory, you know, triggering another and everything else.
Well, it's exactly that. I mean, I had a chat recently with somebody who's writing a book about The Fall, and I said, look, a particular album. I said, I don't know. I can barely remember anything about that record. Mm. I know we recorded some of it in Hitchin and some of it in Iceland. Much more than that, I can't remember. But when we sat down and started talking about it, it was actually Paul Hanley, who was in the band as well.
Yeah.
That things just started flying in, and you could see that happening, as you say, with Woody and Ken Scott. They just were like, do you remember this? Do you remember that? And they're like, talking about the phone, you know, the phone that goes off at the end of Life on Mars.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And it's something like, somebody get that bloody thing, you know. you can just hear a tiny little voice in the background, but they're just triggering all those human stories, you know, these amazing records that we've grown up loving.
Yeah, how wonderful. Was that also the first time you'd met Ken Scott?
And no, I'd been to Abbey Road with Ken Scott previously, and on various different projects that I've been working on, not least the remastering of Ziggy Stardust, which was one of the best days of my life, if I'm frank. So that's it for this episode of the A to Z of David Bowie. But once again, before you go,
if you'd like to support us along the way and be a member of an exclusive Bowie club, you can. And here's how.
There's an exclusive Bowie members club called Cheap Things. And for just $5 a month, wow, you can be part of it.
Why? So now you're thinking $5 isn't much, but what exactly will I get for my hard-earned cash?
Well, in short, you'll get lots of great new exclusive material delivered to your door.
Well, computer, actually, Mark.
Via a system called Patreon.
That's right. Right, Mark. Patreon is a payment system that allows you to contribute your monthly subscription and offers you a portal to access the exclusive material.
Material such as
interviews with Bowie's cohorts and friends.
There'll be regular film Bowie quizzes.
Bowie guitar tutorials.
Unreleased archive written material.
Competitions.
And perhaps most impressively, short films featuring the Cheap Things team.
Ah, that'll be me, Mark, Howard Knock and Jason Reed.
Visiting various Bowie places of interest.
And much more besides.
All this for just $5 a month.
So if you can't resist, simply go to patreon.com, that's patreon.com/cheapthings, all one word, and join up.
There's also a website,
bowiecheapthings.com.
Book early.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.